Evolving the total person is just a fancy title for letting you ask me any question you want to ask. But before I forget it, I would like to tell you something that I meant to mention in my talk this morning, like a lot of other things that it wasn't time enough to say. In all religions that I know of, there has always been the problem, women have been a problem, okay? When you read the Zen stories, most of the time when women are referred to or mentioned at all, it's some old hag that sort of caused some monks trouble, or some nun that's usually left nameless has enlightened some monks accidentally. And also, in the past, we really know only in the history of religions of men who were the teachers or leaders, although there have been women, women teachers too. And I just read in the LA Times, there is a German scholar, a woman who lives in this country, who has just written a revolutionary book called In Memory of Her, or Remembering Her, or something like this. And she's revising all of the Christian scriptures and has done research on where they omitted reference to women. Also, it's of course a linguistic problem. And she's saying, although we understand, everybody knows when we speak of mankind, you know, everyone is meant by this, including women, but still it leaves out the reference to women, so she's doing something in that field. But I remember reading in the Gospels that I have recently become involved with, according to Thomas, which I find very interesting. Also, Jesus' disciples asked him about women. And I can't exactly quote it, but there was something like, then let Mary go forth or out or away from us, because the feeling was that only men could practice this way or become so-called enlightened or experience that unity. And Jesus said, when Mary has become male, she will be able to, let's say, attain, like we say in our language. There's a story in Buddhism, and again, I don't remember the name of the disciple of Buddha, who at one point handed a pearl necklace to the Buddha. And the Buddha predicted her as a future Buddha. Also, in Buddhist scriptures you read that when a woman becomes male, she will be able to become a Buddha. What that means to me is, and that is I would like to explore with you, and that is in reference to what I mean being the total person, is, and in fact, if you get this, you'll be able to answer all koans. It is at the moment when she handed over the pearl necklace, if you vanish, as she did vanished in that action, you're neither male nor female. So you have become the complete person. You have become male also. When we have absolute self, absolute self is every time when we let go of particular self. And letting go of particular self is really not my doing. It is not by my will that I do this, but it is what happens in the Dharma. In the Western world, we have been, especially in the Judeo-Christian tradition, taught only the aspect of the Creator. In Western religions, actually Christianity is not a Western religion, it also comes from the East, God is the Creator. There is no teaching of God as the destroyer. And in Buddhism we have that aspect, not because it is Buddha's fancy idea or some theology or theory that he created, but simply because he looked at what is, at the Dharma. To become the total person is when we realize both aspects of creation and destruction, which make up our life, which bring about life. So from moment to moment, we have a self, a particular self, and that self is being dissolved again into the next action, into the next moment, and that we call death in Buddhism. So at the moment when I die to myself, I am dying to the particular self, and at that moment I become complete, the absolute or the total. Being, non-being, both combined. And when we are only living in suchness, in just what is as it is, we do not even have to surface always to the point where we say, oh, that's male or female. We don't have to interpret it anymore. There is pure action. Pure action means that I emerge from this moment of having given up myself or been dissolved, however you want to look at it, or become nothingness or empty. I emerge again into a particular self, and that particular self is manifesting spontaneously, momentarily, and then is dissolved again. As I said this morning, we create problems when we get stuck in any one of these particular manifestation moments or forms. We latch on to something, to a moment because we like it, or to an idea that arises, and we hang on to an idea. And that is what the Buddha named as the cause of suffering, latching on to an idea, dwelling on something. He didn't teach any ideas. He only wanted us to become free, to become liberated from all ideas. And as soon as we create ideas and dwell on them, we have suffering, even if we think they're good ideas. There is a feminine and a male and a female aspect in the universe. But the universe doesn't think that. The universe didn't say that. We do that. Also, we have created God and Buddha. And actually, they're just names. So are men and women. They're just labels, designation. So we can live much better and much easier if we do not attach to labels and names. Of course, we still have to use language, and we use it, but to free ourselves from the attachment to it and to see what lies beyond. And of course that requires some practice and experience. Like everyone here has pointed out, at the root of this is the experience. You have to have your own experience of that absolute self. But it is not as difficult to get as we think if we stop running after it or searching for it. And you know, Master Joshi always just said, have a cup of tea. That is where you are born and where you die. Where you can become the total person, where you become, we can become a woman, you can become liberated from being a woman. And that's not only when we drink tea, but every time we move or do something. If we're totally there, and given to the act and dissolved in it, if we allow it to be dissolved, to be given to it, then we have no residue, and that is called not to create any more karma. You live, but you do not accumulate residue karma. That I just wanted to say, so please, if you have questions, I invite you. If I can answer them, I will. If not, I'll just be silent. Yes.
Two questions. One isn't a question, one is I'm more curious about your experience being a young woman in the Zen monastery. Maybe you just talk a little bit more about that. But the other is a question that I wanted to ask the panel last night, which is there any place or any value in sexual relations?
Very difficult question. You want me to ask the last one, the question, is there any value in is the question was, is there any value in sexual relationship between teacher and student? You're talking about Zen?
Yes.
Teachers? Zen. Mm. I don't know if there's any value in that. But I would also say, would also not easily say there is no value in it. The reason is because in order to bring a human being to enlightenment, a true and genuine teacher is free to use any method, any way that he sees is the right at that moment. For instance, you know all the horror stories in Rinzai Zen where people's bones were broken and like Uman's, you know, foot was caught in the gate and broken, and I mean there has been what we might call bodily injury, but that was just the point when he was enlightened. So the question is, what is more important to you, you know, body? And I wouldn't answer for anyone in this. I think each person has to find his own answer to that question. I would not propose it. I would not propose it as a method. On the other hand, Zen masters are free to use any method, and it's the teaching, the training is individual. That there is a danger, of course, that they may be selfish. And as I said yesterday, I have no good suggestion to anyone how to find a teacher other than you have to go, like the Buddha said, test it in your own heart. You, if you meet a person and something responds in you, and you know, I feel right about that person, because that is already your wisdom functioning in you. And you have to trust that wisdom and then take it from there. Certainly, if one takes a teacher, it is necessary to have faith or trust. Otherwise, there is no way you can work together. And if from the beginning you feel uncomfortable or there is no trust, it is better to look for another teacher. And you had another question? In the monastery. You wanted to know. I was talking a little bit at the lunch meeting about that with the other teachers. What I learned mostly is that when in life some hardship comes our way and strikes us, and the tendency is to feel great pity and sorrow for oneself, that is just the greatest gift I found in my life. When I was in a monastery in Japan, being the only woman, being not Japanese, not speaking the language, not having a friend in a monastery, and even the Roshi didn't know me very well, so just from a few encounters, I had no one to turn to in my pain, in my suffering, in my real physical pain. You know. But at that time, I really learned to appreciate the koan. I really began to understand when they said, you must merge with the koan, or the koan is your only friend, or it's like your lover, or whatever image you have. And I invested everything there. Whenever a problem came, when pain came or whatever, I just turned it all into that. And it was so beneficial. And then I want to tell you another thing. I could practice with the monks in the meditation hall, but of course I couldn't sleep with them there. I had my own place to go to for sleeping. And I couldn't take a bath with them. And anyone here who has done Daisashin knows how painful it can get. You know, by the third, fourth day, your bones are hurting. And the monks were allowed a bath every fifth day. And the first session I did with them, nobody had thought about it. We had forgotten about the bath situation, so I had no bath. And I was sent out of the sendo to take a walk in the monastery garden while they were taking their bath. So I felt very sorry for myself. And I remember this great self-pity that I didn't know in all these 5 years I had practiced here before, but suddenly that came up, all this pity for myself. But I guess it was the exhaustion of the sesshin and the pain. So I wandered around in the garden, and there is a cemetery, and I went to the top of it where I wanted to sit with the highest spirits, where the abbots are buried. So I'm sitting under this tree, and I could see from there the bathhouse below, and the smoke coming up, and I visualized the monks and myself in that bath, and I said, oh, that hot bath, how good it would feel. And suddenly, I came to my senses, by that I mean my wisdom senses spoke up and said, come on, what are you doing here? You do zazen. So I sat down and I did zazen. And the time went by, and I don't know how long I sat, but next time I looked up, I actually saw, it was like Disneyland, if you have seen the Haunted Mansion, you know, where they have the holographs, whatever we call them, and where the people are dancing in the room and then suddenly they all become smoke. Well, I saw all the masters, Joshu, Uman, all of them coming out of this chimney, and then they became smoke. I could see their faces, then they disappeared in smoke. And then it was gone. And I said, that was the whole thing. That was the whole thing of the craving, the bath, everything. It was nothing but smoke. And it was just gone. And I was cleaner, I think. And I felt more purified than ever after a bath with water. You know? So that was a great lesson for me, that I learned to take whatever comes and see it as, well, it's a practice. But by practice, I don't mean it exactly that way. It sounds a little bit forced or artificial. But just for what it is, and to see neither negative nor positive, but to see for what it is, and that in itself is beneficial. That was really a great lesson for me. And another experience I had there was, it was very hot. In the month of June, it rains for 1 month in Kyoto. They have a word for that season. Every day, and it's very hot and very humid. And you sit in the monastery, your legs are stuck together, and you hurt, and you can't move. And you're dripping inside and outside. You're sweating from pain, and it's raining, and everything is just a drip. And I got my period. I thought, well, here I am. And all this misery, and then that in addition to that. And I began to feel sorry for myself a little bit again. But suddenly, the Sanzen bell rang, and you had to run to get in, because that Roshi only took a certain number of people every time, a few. And if you didn't run, you just wouldn't get in line. I didn't know why, I had really no answer, but something propelled me off my seat, and I ran and sat in line. And when I got into his room, he was sitting there like a mountain, empty room. And I went in front of him and I sat. And suddenly I straightened up. And I felt incredible surge of energy. And I suddenly felt I had a great power over him, because I had something he didn't have. And I just sat there the way he did. And he asked me some question. I answered very spontaneously and disappeared. And it was really a good experience. So what sometimes we think are our disadvantages, you know, our misery, it was a great advantage that day for me, I know. But it happened because I couldn't dissipate it, you see? That is a very important thing to know if you do sesshin, to keep it all within, because the purpose, if you practice Rinzai Zen, is to invest it in your koan, and then, when it's the right time, to let it out in sansen, right? You don't want to go around in kinin and talk to your friend, oh, I feel miserable, is that? You just dissipate that energy that you need to cut through all that stuff. Ramakrishna once said, it's a very interesting, well, to me a very interesting story, because, you know, in Zen practice we use a kesaku, looks like a wooden sword, to cut off delusions, dreams, thinking, and so forth. And Ramakrishna, who had a visualization practice, he always visualized the Divine Mother. And whenever he just thought of the Divine Mother, he was in a trance. And he was in samadhi, just the Divine Mother, that was all he had to think of and visualize. And one day he realized that that was his hindrance, that was his hang-up. And he said, with all the power and with all his might, he gathered his energy, and it must have just all come together here, you know, in his hara, and with one blow of the sword, he used those words, he cut through the image of the Divine Mother and soared beyond. So anything that we hold, that we are hung up on, that's why the Buddha said not to create, not to have any views, right? Not to have any opinions, not to have any ideas on which we get stuck, then we are free. And when you sit in a monastery with monks, for most of the time, you don't think of yourself as a woman or as of them as men. You just forget the whole thing. But there are these moments when I said, when we come into particular self, when we have a self-consciousness, when we have awareness of ourselves in our particular situation, that is the time when we realize now the absolute, that which is unformed and unmanifest, manifests just as that, as it is. Because that's the only way we can have awareness of the unmanifest, when it makes itself visible and tangible and audible and so forth. And it does it in its particular way, which you experience as your particular self at that moment. So for a moment we have self-consciousness, and then that is dissolved again. So the total person really means a being who has self, no self, self, no self. And realizing that the whole thing is nothing but your consciousness. So essentially what happens is self looking at self. And that's very important to know, because then we know if somebody comes to me and complains about another person, what they're doing is not, or let's say blaming another person or being mad at them, is not damage, is not really hurting the other person, but they're just revealing their own state of mind, what's going on in their own mind. We are always revealing ourselves, constantly, because there is only self. But it's of course not the ego self. We're talking about great self. And to testify to that means you find maybe a little bit of wisdom in yourself to start with, and that brings you to practice or to a teacher. That is already wisdom stirring. And then you have to investigate that more, and you have to create faith in that wisdom, in that little bit. And that's why in the beginning we need a teacher to help you to see that and to foster that. And then you must, at one point, this invariably happens in everyone's life, the person that practices, there comes a point when you have to make a conscious leap. You have to take a conscious step of accepting that in yourself and say, all right, that is true nature, or this is Buddha nature, I am that. That is a very conscious step decision. And it happened to me when I was at the beginning of my practice, and I went for instruction and I asked the monk, I'm sitting now half lotus, I cannot sit full lotus yet. Should I put my left leg or my right leg on top? Because I read, you know, different things, that like, if you put the left leg on top means this, and the right leg on top means that. And you know what he said to me? It was such a turning point in my life. He maybe doesn't know that what happened to me. He said, well, that depends whether you want to be a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. I said, what? That's up to me to decide? I thought, I didn't say to him. So what? Then why not be a Buddha? Which leg do you put up to be a Buddha? Like Nietzsche said, if there's God, who wouldn't want to be God? Yeah. We all want to be that, the highest, because that is our true nature. It is the highest. It is the best. And you have to recognize that in yourself. And I am not in agreement with people. It's a custom in this country that I really think it's a kind of false front that say, I'm just your ordinary average neighborhood guy. I am not. And you're also not. You're very special. And the most important person here is you. But you have to realize that real you. Like my Roshi once said, you should realize Buddha, and when you manifest, you shouldn't manifest like a little mosquito Buddha. You'd be a big Buddha. So that is the first, I think, thing that you have to do. And like Master Rinzai has always pointed that out to his disciples, that there is nothing wrong with you. You already have that Buddha nature. What's wrong with you is you have no faith in it. And every psychologist will tell you that. But of course they're dealing with a different kind of self. So you must first unearth that wisdom, or that Buddha nature which is already in us, or in you, and then encourage it, and then take faith in it, and then act from it. So we have to not only just believe in it and go shyly through the world and thinking, because again, that is in our Christian upbringing, to be, certainly we should be humble, but there is a false sense of, what's the word I'm looking for? False
piety.
False piety. And it shouldn't be, it shouldn't also be a pious coma that we're in. But when we meditate. But you have to realize true nature, just as it is. To see things as they are, and that requires a clear mind, and that's why we meditate. Yeah.
Could you talk some about why you're a monk and what that is for you to take a deal from that sort of school?
To tell you the truth, I have no time to think about that. You know, I said it once when I was put on the spot by someone. I said, well, what are you, a monk, you know, what do you call yourself, a monk or a nun? And it occurred to me, well, what am I? Because I wasn't trained with nuns. I was always trained with men, by monks, with monks. So I wondered at that moment, I said, yeah, well, maybe there's something different about training of nuns that I don't know.
I don't mean whether you're a monk or not, I mean shaving your head.
Oh, that's only that. For me, it was a very natural thing. Sin was not something I decided on. That was already in my life. In fact, it's been in former lives, not Zen, but Buddhist way. And so I just continue. Like what I said to some Oriental monks not long ago, because I was the only Western only one born in the West, and I said, well, one of us had to take the first step and take birth in the West. And there was no one there waiting for me to say, you're a reincarnation of this or that, you know, person to help me along. I had to find my own way in this world. But I found it from childhood, actually following the inner voice, the wisdom. That was very strong in me as a child. And speaking of being put on the spot, when I was about 8 years old, I remember somebody asked me suddenly out of the, you know, blue sky, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I'd never thought of that at the time. It probably wasn't a question in my mind, no doubt about it, what I was going to be. But also, I had no concept of it. And so what shot into my mind was, I want to shine like a star. That's what I told them. What else could I say? And, well, that when I look at it now, that's what I really wanted, I think. So when I came to Zen in a very curious way, and it's a really a funny story, but it was natural, a natural step. And what's important, though, about it, I think, is that since you asked the question about robes and hairstyles and so forth, that never had any, I didn't feel anything about that at all. Because I was living that kind of life already in my heart. And I realized at the time, ceremony, nothing was important to me. That is really for the outside world, I think. For me, and this is, I would like for all of you to know and to realize, we are so free, you don't realize how free we are. Nothing has ever put us in bondage except our own thinking, our own ideas. That means if you want to live the life or the way of the Buddha, you can do exactly that. If you want to take the vows by yourself, you can. There are books, you can read them, you can practice, you can live like that. And that's what I did. I just lived it because it felt right to me. And the ceremony and all that came much later. And even if I hadn't had the ceremony, I didn't ask for it, it was given to me, I would have continued to live this way. Maybe I wouldn't have shaved my head, I don't know. But even that's not important to me. Sometimes I shave, sometimes I don't. You know, my name is Moonheart. Look at the moon. Does it always look the same? One time bald, the other time still little, then little more. It's always different. That's the way I am.
Buddhist conference or organization you will be attending in 2 years that you would suggest the rules be the same for male and female monks here, is that you?
Are you talking about the fellowship, the World Fellowship of Buddhists that I
yes.
mentioned in Sri Lanka?
Yeah.
And what was your question?
I was just curious about exactly what sort of organization is this?
That's an organization of actually mostly lay people. It's called the World Fellowship of Buddhists, and it consists of members both of the monastic tradition and the lay people, mostly Asian countries. But anyone that is, you have to become a member. They approve of you or your organization. So you have a regional center, maybe a Buddhist center, and you can apply for membership. And it was held this year in Sri Lanka. And in 2 years, it will be held in Nepal. So it's every 2 years. But they do know the rules are not the same there because it's mostly Theravadan. It originated in a Theravadan country. And especially Sri Lanka considers herself the only real, maybe true Buddhist place in the world today. So, however, there were a lot of Mahayana monks there, and from the Tibetan tradition, and one of the Tibetan monks, he in fact was the representative of the Dalai Lama, brought this up in one of the committee meetings, that there was too much discrimination, or there shouldn't be any discrimination between, you know, in the Sangha, between whether you're Theravadan or Mahayana monk, because in the opening ceremonies they put the Theravadan monks, or the Sinhalese monks, on a high platform, on a stage, where also the prime minister and the guests of honor and so forth were seated. And the rest of us were seated on the floor, although the floor meaning the big audience hall, where we had, since we were delegates of different countries, we had signs with the name of the country and specially assigned seats, but mixed in with all the other people. And, you know, it is a custom for Buddhist monks they don't have to stand for any worldly leader, or if a national anthem is played, the monks remain seated because they're not bowing to any worldly authority. And that goes back to ancient times, the Buddha's time, when the monks did not have to bow to any kings or emperors. The emperor would bow to them. So also in this meeting, of course, we remain seated, but everybody else is standing. Now, the Mahayana monks were seated on the floor with the other people. And so this monk brought up this question and said, well, it's highly recommended that for the next meeting we treat all the monks equally, that they should all be seated on the same platform. And then I stood up, again, I'm the only woman, I'm always this little voice, this nagging old woman, you know. They look at me, and when they see me stand up, they already think, well, whatever she's going to say, we're going to defer to a women's meeting. And that happened. This happened to be the committee, the standing committee for, what is it called? Solidarity. And so I simply asked that monk, I said, when you speak of the monks, do you mean by that term female as well as male monks altogether? Or how do you use this term? Because I said in the United States, and this is in my particular organization I came from, we decided in our papers only to use one term, monk, for both male and female. And he was a little bit taken back because he had probably never heard this question or thought about it. So he answered, he said, that's the Tibetan monk. He answered, well, I mean the Sangha. Now, if you are in a Theravadan country and a Theravadan monk, the Sangha is, of course, only male. So again, this is the same problem. So again, I had to ask the question. The Sangha, does it include female monks? And he then agreed, yes, that all monks, male, female, should be seated on the same platform. But I doubt that this will happen if there's in a Theravadan country and if the majority of the monks are Theravadan monks. So it will remain to be seen what happens then. And when I was beginning to speak, the chairman of that committee said, oh, that's because it had just been decided that a Buddhist women's association should be formed within that fellowship, World Fellowship of Buddhists, because all of the women that were there felt there was not any space for them to do or say anything. And he said at that point, well, that's a question for the women's committee. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't think so. I am here as a U.S. delegate, and I'm standing right here and now as a monk, and I'm talking from that position. It has nothing to do with the Women's Association. It's a question that it concerns us all. So he, of course, I had to admit my question, and then it went into the report, so I don't know what's going to happen. Yes?
You spoke last night, you mentioned that you found actually life in Germany much more, I forgot the word you used, but it was much more harsh than life in the monastery or life in the world. And I wonder, in our times now, I'm living with the danger of nuclear weapons, and they keep going, and people keep building them. I wonder if you have some perspective on practice and how to live or react or act with that kind of danger, and how to also make peace with it. I don't feel at peace with it at all.
Mm. When I referred to the harshness of life, it wasn't to the harshness of German life, but to the harshness of the life during wartime. So I think your question is a very good one. In fact, the fear of nuclear war is much more prevalent in Europe than it is here. Mm-hmm. People are much more scared over there than they're here. I mean, they live in constant terror. They're neurotic about it. And especially the Germans, because they had so many wars in their land. And also sitting right on the border with the Russians, it is a very living reality for them. And of course, I don't know why this seems to be my karma. First I was German-born, when all Germans were hated in the world. I traveled with a German passport. Then I became American, and now the Americans are being disliked. So it's a good thing to be a Buddhist monk. You can make free yourself from this. Because there's a real anti-American wave in Europe, and that is not against Americans per se, against Reagan, but you know how the general public is, just the way in this country people were conditioned to hate all Germans, not just the Nazis, but all Germans. The same thing happens there, that people lump everything together and they feel all Americans are supporting Reagan because they elected him into office and so forth. So they have a terrible, terrible fear. And I feel very, very sorry for those people, because they are, it's a real fear for them. They cannot relax from it 1 minute. And also, the danger is more in that fear than in the bomb. Because fear, as I have seen in my life, is a much more dangerous weapon to manipulate people with. And I'm not being manipulated anymore, I'm free from that. But people are being manipulated by fear, and into fear and through fear to react and to do and to act in a certain way that they want you to act. I think why I came on a religious path, even as a child during the war, is because I felt totally insecure in the world that we call the outside world. And I found something secure and stable within, which I didn't know what it was, but it was a refuge that I could go to. It wasn't God, because I didn't believe in God anymore. I saw God wasn't doing anything to help us, and I prayed every night and nothing happened. The war didn't stop. So I lost faith in that too. But still, there remained something in me that was, I couldn't name, but I felt safe in, and I would go to that. That is what you have to discover. That is what the Buddha said, the deathless. And until you have found that, you will, from lifetime to lifetime, being manipulated into, there will be other types of fears, other threats. In fact, there always have been wars and threats and persecutions in this world. And the truth is, we have never learned from them. The Holocaust, which you can see on television practically every night in Los Angeles till you're sick of it, has not been a lesson. Because we here, who are making these movies and showing them all over the world, are doing the same thing, much worse, tenfold worse, than the Nazis could ever have dreamt up. Death by gas is peaceful compared to what we are planning now. And we are all involved in it. We let it happen the way the German people let it happen with Hitler. We have the bombs, we have the missiles, we're ready to push the button. It is in man's mind to use them, otherwise they wouldn't have been built. And moreover, when I look, not only that, but far greater horrors and crimes are committed in films, on television, I mean, things that people dream up, these horror films and horror movies, those are the minds who destroy in this world. They don't have to go out and turn and open up a gas valve. They destroy your mind, and you're not even aware of it. Or children's, or the people who are maybe still sleeping and dreaming. And yet, I also learned, and I know today I'm 53 or 54 years old. When I was 20 or 21, you know, we have an expression in German, Sturm und Drang. I was very energetic, very strong. I was healthy and young, and I had great ideas. And when I looked at the world, like any teenager today looks at the world, or in any generation, I was not satisfied with that world, and I thought, something has to be done here. I'm going to change the world. Well, then you set out and you try your ideas, and then suddenly it's getting more and more difficult to even get a few people to listen to you. So these kids come up with, you know, they have to find some avenue to let out their energy and to show that they're different, have a different idea. So we get all these things like hippies and what we have now is punk. So in Europe, I'm a punk, you know, they all look like me. They shave their heads and they wear strange clothes. So in a, I learned, and of course you all know this because that's also what Buddha taught, we cannot change the world because there is no world. It does not exist outside of us. What we can change is our view of the world. I can change only myself by revealing my true self to myself. Suddenly everything becomes changed. Suddenly I have a different view of the world. I don't see the world the way the frightened Germans see it now. And that is why I can help them. I'm not stuck, I'm not fear-struck in it. Nothing scares me. I'm not afraid to die, I've already died. You're looking at my... a fear as if to take a hypothesis and accept it as real. And that's what the Buddha called speculative viewing. He totally and utterly exposed that because his time and the religious thinkers of his time were, I mean, India was filled with that speculative thinking of what life is, what death is, and he totally exposed it and cut it all off. And that's what you have to do. We may have to suffer some physical pain. But our true nature, and that is what you should realize and identify with, not with the impermanent parts of it, is not destroyed ever by any bomb. So you do not need to fear anything. It cannot be touched by anything. It can never be destroyed, nor added to or diminished by anything. But it doesn't help you if I say this to you. And again, therefore, I always have to say, you have to practice. That is the way. Better suffer the pain there than to go through your life with this pain in your mind all the time. And then the world becomes changed. If each one of us, if we work on ourselves and change ourselves, it changes the world. All you have to do is, this is how I look at history. I say, look, what one man has done, Shakyamuni Buddha, Jesus was another. There have been many. You can look at many people in this world, even recent Zen masters that have died recently, like Sokyan in New York. What has one person's life, the impact it had, and you can only already see within 20, 30, 40, 50 years how it unfolded, how many people have become influenced and changed by it. And that is how you should work for peace in the world, because peace is our nature, it cannot be made. We only have to realize that our nature, the Dharma, has no conflict. Our nature is peace. We cannot make peace. When we try to make peace, we only create conflict. And therefore, I say, there's a wonderful saying in German, unfortunately it doesn't translate well into English, but there is a saying, to become a father is not hard, but to be a father is very hard. So I turn that around. In German it sounds, Buddha sein ist gar nicht schwer, Buddha werden dagegen sehr. That means to be a Buddha, not hard. You try to become one, very difficult. There was a hand, yes.
Could you talk a little more about how you meant to die?
To die. Depends on what your perception is of dying. No, I already showed you. This is my life after death. You see it now. The way you die is by not resisting the Dharma. then you have to look at what is the Dharma doing. This is what I said at the beginning of the talk. The Dharma, from moment to moment, favors you with life. It gives you a momentary manifestation form. The Buddha once said this. There's a terminology for that in Buddhism. One life and death cycle is called one kshana, or in Japanese, one setsuna, something like 1/75th of a second is one cycle of birth and death. It is because of our conditioning and because of our education and training in the West that we think only of forward movement. We think we are moving forward from birth to death. And this forward movement is false, is a false understanding of what's really happening, because it leaves out the death cycles, or the moments of rest, the moments of no self, the moments of dissolution. Like I said earlier, we have no teaching of a destroyer, only the creator. But the reality is, and the wonderful thing is, that Dharma manifests constantly its law. You can constantly observe it. For instance, there isn't anything in technology today that we can do, that they have invented, that lies outside of the law of the universe, that could function apart from that law. For instance, I often use the example, when you have a car with a standard gear shift, if you want to change gears, you have to empty out third gear into neutral before you can go into fourth. I see Dharma everywhere I look at. You go to the movies, you look at a film, you see this is the illusion, only pictures. And that's how we look at our life. We only see the moments of manifestation. We don't perceive the moments of emptiness. But between each frame on this, in the movie, it wouldn't work if there wasn't a blank. If you didn't have a blank that took away the first picture, the first projection, with the second one and the third one, would you only see a mess? You couldn't see the clear picture anymore. The reason why we have, why we can live, why we can exist, is because we are that law. And there are moments, in every moment we are liberated from the moment before. Every moment we are emptied out from that. That means, see what I'm doing with my hand? As every moment I'm empty. If I wasn't empty out, I couldn't move my hand from here to there. It would be stuck. But you can move, you can get up, because you're emptied out from sitting. The whole process is that. And if any of you are coming from a Christian background or are interested in Christianity, it's interesting to know that Jesus, when he was asked by his disciples, where can we find our Father? And of course, if you're a Buddhist, you know he means the truth, or the Dharma. That's how you have to read that. He said, the Father is within you. And then the disciples said, but how can we recognize the Father within you? How do I find the truth in myself? Where is it to be found? And Jesus said, gave a very interesting answer. Now, this is according to the Gospels of Thomas, a book which is not recognized by the church. But I use it freely. The Christian churches invite me to give talks, lectures in Germany and here in this country. And I use it freely, and I tell them right from the beginning, even if these sayings are not attributed to Jesus, I don't care. Whoever said it spoke the truth. And that's important for us. So he said, it is a movement and a rest. Isn't that interesting? He didn't say it's your Father in yourself. A movement and a rest. Rest. And he described just exactly what we call Dharma activity. Now, the movement is not simply a forward movement. It is only one movement. But the movement actually has two modes of moving, and one is expansion, and then there's a rest. When it has fully expanded, has reached its limitation, there is a rest. And then it begins on a contracting cycle, or dissolution, or destructive, however, whatever word you want to use, a cycle of disappearing again into emptying out, into nothingness. And when that has been reached, there's another rest. This activity, again, you can experience in your breathing. Breathing consists of breathing in, there's a moment of rest, neutrality, before it turns around and becomes out-breath. And when you have breathed out completely, there's a moment of rest, or neutral or zero, before breath comes in again. I am not breathing. I discovered I don't have to do anything. The Dharma is breathing me. I just sit there and watch it. It's coming in, and it goes out and is shared with everything. It's not my breath. So I realized I am favored with life from everything. It comes from everywhere. And then as I breathe out, or I am being breathed out, I'm at the same time being dissolved into everything. And that is our cycle, simply that, back and forth. Being dissolved into emptiness, no self, that means becoming absolute, and coming back into self-consciousness again. And at that moment, it's creation. That moment when you have awareness is the moment when you are the master and in charge to create yourself for that moment. How you manifest that at that moment, that is what is important. And if that is contaminated with attachment to past ideas, that means to that extent that you are attached, you cannot manifest in this moment. That means if 50% of you are thinking about the ice cream you just ate an hour ago, that 50% is not free, is not fully there to manifest, to fully live in this moment. That's what is meant by that, by living and dying. And the great death, there's a great death we talk about, is when once, or maybe more than once, if you can completely forget yourself and totally transcend any knowledge, any awareness of self. And that we call samadhi in Buddhism. And when you awaken from that, that is called satori. And that's what the Buddha experienced in his, when he saw the morning star, and suddenly he realized there is the manifestation of that emptiness. It is momentary and it fluctuates. It comes and it goes, and comes and it goes. And that's how it's one. It's not there's the absolute and there's the particular. They are alternating cycles. The absolute manifests as the particular. The particular returns into the absolute, renews itself and comes back out again. So we really have a new life from moment to moment. And that's why in many ways, in many ways you want to think about it, or dimensions you want to think about it, truly this is my life after death. This life, this moment, is after the one before. But also in terms of a longer process, it is.
It seems to really overcome the human, mundane fear of death that we all suffer from, often without knowing, that it somehow takes on connecting this idea, which seems a wonderful concept to me, but doesn't seem at all the same thing as contemplating my own death in the right before my father was going to die this summer. And totally immersing myself in my own death, facing it for a moment, and then losing that awareness, and being now unable to confront my own death so that I can truly live. What you're saying, I think, is very important, but for me, in order to, you know, to make it practical, I would have a lot to do, and I'm not sure how.
You have to practice. Because you just said the word concept. It's a wonderful concept. For me, it's not a concept. It's a living reality. And that's why I say, without practice, you will never understand what these things mean. You will never come into the benefit of it. It's not going to work for you. But it works already in you, and that's all you need to discover. Because without that, you could not exist. You are already being died and born every moment. You just need to become aware of it. That's why the Buddha said all things exist as enlightenment. Everything and everybody. Because Dharma is enlightened. There's nothing imperfect in it. We are, we're talking about our essential nature, about essence. But you see the essence, then it sublimates, becomes more dense and dense and dense into form. If you adhere, if you're attached to its formative aspect, that's where you get into trouble, because form doesn't last, and the fear of death comes with that.
Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about koans, koan spending? I'm asking because, for instance, there are at least one teacher, maybe two that I know of now, that are saying, you know, not using the old system of koans, the standard koan, saying everything in your life is a koan, make up your own koans. You talked about putting everything into your koan. Would you just talk about traditional koan study?
Traditional koans arose from everyday life situation. Some of them were invented by masters. They're great, you know, works of art. they say, for instance, Master Kyogen, who said, life is like this. A man hanging from a branch in a tree, maybe you heard it, okay, with his teeth hanging onto the branch. His hands cannot reach the branch, his feet cannot touch the ground. Under a tree comes a man and says, hey, where's the John? I got to go urgently. Well, they say it differently. They say, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming to the West? All right. So then if you are, let's say you are a Zen teacher hanging up in the tree, you have to answer that man, because that's your job, your duty. But if you do answer him, you fall to the ground and break your neck. If you don't answer, you have neglected your duty. So what do you do? Anyway, life is always like that, it's always putting us in a bind. Now, he used an example, he just made that maybe up, that image. But there are many koans that actually happened out of a situation or a moment. And truthfully, all koans are dealing essentially with the question of life and death. That is really our most urgent question as soon as we come into this world. You know, how we get out of it again, and we all do, and not alive, of course. There's no way out alive of this world. We all die. So that is the basis of the koans. And really, I give koans, people bring their own koans, really, but they don't know it. And so what you do is I help them to find the real question they're asking. And then either it could be phrased so similar to what they brought, or you take a corresponding koan and give it to them. And there are different classes of koans, so the way you practice them depends a little bit on where you're at in your koan practice. With beginning koans, you often just recite them, invoke them inwardly, repeating them. But then later on, there are other koans that deal with difficulty of language and with concepts and so forth, all meant to free us from that, or to show us how we are attached, where we are attached, our attachments, our hang-ups, how we latch onto words. And you can have practiced for 5-6 years severely and you get a koan. And maybe when you're very clear, you know you're free, you're not attached. But a sesshin puts the screws on, puts you under pressure, see? And what do you do when you look at the world again? That's an example of Dharma. If you want to have the essence of something, you press it, okay? You want to have olive oil, you press the olives. You want to have the essence or perfume or some essence of something, you have to squeeze it, to press it out. So that's what they do. If you want to test a most excellent machine, you put it under stress to see how it performs, how it holds up under stress. And I think this is why Christianity doesn't work. They don't have a practice. And I'm teaching a lot of Christians. I teach in Christian churches and monasteries. They ask me to come, so I'm not teaching them Buddhism. I just teach them how to practice their own religion. And that's Buddhism, of course. Eh? Buddhism is to say, amen, so be it. When I'm with Hindus, I say, om. So the koans, it depends on what type of koan you have. And some I say to people, you're totally free, do anything with it you want. You know, you can try any avenue, any way, and that's what you do anyway, because even if I tell you not to think about it, sooner or later you're going to sit there and think, what does this really mean? What does this mean? So you have to go all these ways. If your wisdom is strong already, maybe you listen to the teacher and say, well, okay, I'll do what he or she says, and then you maybe don't sit and think about your koan. But it depends on the practice. Now, what I find difficult for us in the West is that a lot of these koans were created out of Chinese or Japanese, Korean, whatever, literature and incidents. And they involve idioms and references, even in language, that do not make much sense to us or that we cannot relate to. I turned this over, all of these things come from my own experience that I'm talking about, because I went through all of this myself. For instance, I envisioned one day, if you just use the word cow around the world, and you talk to, let's say, just to take two examples, an Indian, East Indian, and a Texan. What do they imagine when they hear the word cow? So you give them a koan that involves something with a cow, which was meant for the Chinese, it has a certain symbolism, you know. And then you give this koan in Texas, they're going to have a totally different understanding of it. So we have to make a bridge or interpret or find new ways to interpret these koans and give them a Western, maybe, dress. Texan dress. A cowboy outfit. Yes, I find them. Mm-hmm. Not for everybody. My teaching and practice with people is very individual. And that's the way the Buddha, well, the wisdom is just like that. You know, it with each person brings his or her own situation. They may think they have a problem, but they are also the solution. And if you have a clear mind, you see the solution. But you don't tell them, you let them find it themselves. So you use... The method is obvious. For some people it's better to just, for instance, the Germans are a thinking, a very hard-thinking people. They always try to solve everything. They have very good minds, very good minds. And they love to sit and meditate. But when they sit a lot, they begin to dwell, to think, to turn things over. So them I often give longer meditation walks in the forest. I make them walk and observe their breath and walk and give them or chanting practices in which they cannot think. So you have to, you know. Yeah.
Do you have your own sangha here?
My sangha is sort of all over the place. It's in this country and in Europe. And
but that one particular place that you hang your hat.
Can you give me one? I need one. Is anyone here can help me? When I was sent out by my Roshi, he said, all you need is a tree.
I had somewhat the same question. You know, if you were associated with a particular school or temple, and also I understand that you travel mostly, and how does one find out about your schedule and where and when you're doing something?
Well, you can, we have a mailing list, and I have a few disciples all over the place, you know, in Northwest and in Canada and in Europe, and Europe and in Seattle, we have a computerized mailing list, and so I feed them the addresses I get. It's not very well organized yet, mainly because we don't have an office, you know, it's always individuals who do this. And sometimes they get married or they move or whatever. So usually every year I send out a list of my activities for the year, where I go and where I can be reached. But I do have an address in Los Angeles, and that's the International Zen Institute of America, which is a very small L-shaped room without any staff or anything. It's just me in there. And I'm a one-man monastery. One woman or one human monastery, traveling monastery. it's not what I wanted or sought out, but you get beyond wanting, you know. Sometimes I hope for, even if it's just a small place, but again, mostly for the sake of some of my students who would like to do longer retreats. And we're working on that. And one German lady came up with an offer of some money that might be a good down payment on something. But again, I don't have the time even to look, you know, for a place. But I know it will happen in time. And it seems that my calling at this time is just that, what I'm doing. There's more and more calls are coming, and so I have to respond and I have to go. Even if the traveling is getting harder. And but it's only hard when I think about it. When you don't think, so you just have to practice this all the time, to be right there in the moment and just to sink into it and forget yourself. And the best way to do that, I found, is just what the Buddha did. Sometimes I, even though I went through this long, you know, Zen tradition and all, and I've been a nun now for 17 years, or what, but I really look at what the Buddha did. Or I look at what Jesus did when he was all alone in the desert. Because that's what I'm alone, and you are also. Essentially, we are all alone. We come into this world alone, and we go out alone. In the end, all you have is your own consciousness to look at, and that's what you're responsible for. But when you realize it completely, you are not alone anymore. It includes everything. So now I'm not alone. I'm constantly in communication with everything. And you have to, and the way to be in that moment, to be one with it, and the easiest way, and the fastest and quickest is instantly go back to your breath. That's what the Buddha practiced. Huh? Just, he found great enjoyment in just realizing a long out-breath. You know, when you feel total relief from something, spontaneously, you say, ah, thank God that's over. Our session is over.